this week on the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast.
I think what you have to learn is you have to learn the basics to understand truly what a story is about, so that when you get to that point where you're going to write, you're not trying too hard to fit a square into a round hole. You are the story structure so that you can focus on writing honestly and rawly and truthfully.
Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, sneakers. Well, I'm still basking in the glow of WriterCon. This year's Writers Conference was the biggest and, in my opinion, the best ever. We had more speakers addressing more topics than ever before, more agents and editors and publishers for our writers to meet. But you know what? Best of all was the people. We are building a true community of writers, of the best and the most generous people in the world, always ready to share ideas and help colleagues. More than anything else, to me anyway, it's the people who make WriterCon special. Jesse, any thoughts now that you've had a little time to dwell on it about your first WriterCon experience?
It's always really great to go to something where everyone is just sort of open and friendly about a thing they love, right? I'm used to it in like a cultural nerd context, like going to Star Trek conventions, right? Where everyone is wonderful around a thing they love, but this was around things people do. And it was just really great to hear all the different ways that people sort of attack their art. And, you know, I had a great time.
Yeah. Amazing professionalism and people in all stages of writing careers, but just a pleasure. That's why we do it year after year. It's just a great chance to get together with people who share your interests. Anyway, my interview guest today is the incredible Robert Degoni. Robert is one of the most successful authors, on the face of the earth, honestly, a New York Times number one and number one Amazon bestseller, author of the Tracy Crosswhite Police series, the Charles Jenkins espionage series. But today he's here to talk about a new book, The World Played Chess, a novel just released earlier this week, a beautiful coming-of-age novel, a poignant, I think deeply personal, thought-provoking novel about a young man's unlikely friendship with a Vietnam vet during a summer between high school and college. This is a very special novel, which the Providence Journal has called Degoni's masterpiece. I can't wait to talk to him about that. But first, the news. First item has to do with TikTok. Back in the news again, you may recall in a previous podcast, not that long ago, I discussed the growing influence of TikTok, the social media app, on book sales. But let me tell you, that influence has skyrocketed since I did that story. Right now, the U.S. has a summer fiction hit that came as a big surprise to everyone. A big surprise because the book was released 5 years ago, but now tops the New York Times paperback list, tops the Amazon list as well. It's called It Ends With Us by Colleen Hoover. It's a contemporary romance. So you might be wondering, why is it seeing this resurgence of sales? Book Talk, which of course is a subdivision, a hashtag on TikTok. Bunch of people made TikTok videos talking about how emotionally moved they were by this, and that drove book sales big time. That seems to be what happens with these book talk videos. It especially promotes backlist for For instance, other books that have benefited from TikTok campaigns include The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, which is a literary novel based obviously upon Greek literature, Greek myth, and We Were Liars by E. Lockhart, which is a YA novel. Both of these books, like the first one, have been out for several years, but now are suddenly popular. What impresses me most about BookTok's power to promote books is that it seems to be entirely grassroots in nature. And speaking as somebody who's been publishing and in the book world for three decades now, I can tell you that doesn't happen that often. More typically, huge surges in sales are driven by New York publishers or campaigns or Oprah or other television appearances. But here, through completely self-made content, TikTok users are creating the sort of literary publicity that literally money cannot buy. Media literate young people are being drawn to promotion, even though they have no financial stake in the product. Of course, publishers are taking notice, and I can guarantee they will respond quickly and try and get into the game. The reason I'm leading with this story, Red Sneaker Writers, is because this is a new potential publicity machine. I know many of you have tried social media, you've been on YouTube, and you've tried blogs, but this appears to be a new way to create a hit, even from backlist. TikTok actually drives sales in this phenomenal way. According to the recent Publishers Weekly article that Jesse's showing you on the screen, TikTok has sold over 300,000 copies of backlist book these years. There are now special separate BookTok tables at Barnes & Noble where they display books that have benefited from BookTok campaigns. And listen to this, hashtag BookTok videos have garnered over 18 billion combined views. Yes, you heard me right, billion, not million, billion. It's another hashtag, TikTok made me read it, that is almost as popular. I mean, if you're like me, you maybe thought, well, TikTok, that's all just funny videos and people dancing and makeup tips and whatnot, not serious book conversations, but nope. So everybody is looking for a way to get their galleys in front of TikTok influencers. They seem to prefer, TikTok reviewers seem to prefer fiction, seem to prefer books that have a big twist or a very emotional ending, books that'll make you sob. Here's a couple of accounts you might target if you're going to try this. A Life of Literature, which in which two sisters frequently review books on TikTok, or Moon Girl Reads, which, by the way, was the one responsible for promoting We Were Liars. So what do you think, Jesse? Should we forget about Facebook and YouTube and just get on TikTok?
I mean, every time there's a new technology like this, there's always something organic that comes out of it like this.
Right.
And, you know, I used to think people my age, around my age, and I'm 40, were too old for TikTok. But literally, as we've been driving around Louisville, Kentucky, where I am, people in the backseat have just been watching TikTok videos over and over again. So we might not be making them, but we are certainly watching them. So, you know, strike while the iron's hot, I would say. I mean, Facebook is too massive now to really have this kind of Facebook try to push everyone into groups, right? And right. That's where like-minded people find things, good or bad. But you can't really do this on Facebook, you know, your newsfeed anymore. So yeah, take advantage of these things while they're there, I'd say.
Well, but there's so much. I mean, it's one thing after another, right? I mean, just a few months ago, I did my first Clubhouse interview, audio only. And now Twitter is, of course, imitating Clubhouse with Twitter conversations, which I did about, I don't know, 20 of to promote WriterCon before it happened. Twitter has announced that it's now launching something called Twitter Communities, which is basically, it looks a lot like Facebook groups, except it's on Twitter. Yeah, you can get a group of people with similar interests together and try and keep out people who are just lurking and not really interested. But if everybody's imitating everything, is there just going to be too much for anybody to handle? Or are we ultimately just going to have one gigantic social media platform that controls the universe?
people are comfortable, like different people are comfortable with different kinds of tools. So, you know, the more the merrier, I say. Like, yeah, eventually they'll all merge into some evil mega, mega conglomerate that we can write fiction novels about how evil they are. So it's all going to work out.
Okay. I've got a new book coming out in October. I have three children. Surely I can get a TikTok review of this book. Well, so stay tuned. I will be updating this story later.
Okay, listen, I would love TikTok reviews of you playing PlayStation games, like reviews of PlayStation games. People would love that.
That would probably be more interesting than me talking about my books, right?
I'm just saying, bring them in. So
it'll be a Twitter Twitch kind of thing.
Yes.
No, my son, Harry, you know, plays video games on his Twitch channel, Bernhardt Games, and has all kinds of followers, which I don't understand, but that's a whole different thing. Great channel, though. Great kid. Okay. One more news item, which I think my interview guest will be as not happy to hear about as I was. According to NBD Bookstand, there has been a recent decline in thriller sales. But it may be that the decline is not because readers are less interested in thrillers, but because some titles are getting categorized differently as women's fiction or something like that, as publishers are strategizing how best to sell the books. Anyway, according to BookScan, thriller sales are down about 6% this year. But many books that have thriller elements, like the one Jesse's put up on the screen, are now being categorized in other hot areas, like women's contemporary fiction, or just general fiction, or young adult fiction, where that's appropriate. And they're driving growth in those categories instead of driving growth in the thriller category. Part of this may be an increasing awareness of the majority, the large number of female readers out there. Thrillers have historically, although I don't know why anybody would think that today, but historically they've been associated with men and male authors. But female writers are increasingly appealing to a female readership, which may explain this book on the screen, Laura Dave's recent bestseller, The Last Thing He Told Me. Well, it's being categorized as general fiction, but let me tell you, I've read it. It's a lot like a thriller. Anyway, it's currently number 2 on Amazon's most read fiction site and 17th, and it's the 17th week on the list. So here's another takeaway for you, Red Sneaker writers. Categorization, whether it's being done by your publisher or if you're self-publishing, whether you're doing it itself, can be very important. Try different things. Don't be afraid to try something new. Don't be afraid to change it if something's not working. You may not tamper with the book, but the category may be very important. All right, let's get to the interview, can we? My interview today is with the incredible best-selling author, Robert Dagoni. Hey, Bob, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, and thank you for the very kind introduction. It's humbling, so thank you.
Oh, shoot. I could have gone on for another couple minutes, but I think people would rather hear from you than me. So I've got a traditional first question on this show, which I didn't warn you about. So, you know, just do the best you can. If you could give, we got a lot of writers, a lot of people who are thinking about writing, watching. If you could give those writers one piece of advice, and I know you're teaching something tomorrow morning, in fact, a writing seminar on plotting. But if you had to narrow it down and give one piece of advice, what would it be?
Learn the craft. I came at writing from a journalism background. I wrote for the LA Times. I decided to go to law school. I could write legal briefs. I could write all kinds of things. And when I decided I was going to write novels, I failed miserably. And I failed miserably until I took a step back and began to study the craft of writing novels. And, you know, as you know, Bill, there's a craft to it. There are certain things that need to happen at certain times and in the story. And, you know, characters have certain roles. And it was really just, I knew I could write, but I needed to learn how to write in the particular style of a novel. And that's a different, whole different thing. So there's a lot of great books out there on the craft. If you're looking for them, you know, there's Save the Cat. There's Chris Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey. Saul Stein's book on writing. Stephen James has some great stuff out there. Donald Moss, writing the breakout novel. And, you know, and it's I think it's important if writers want to save themselves some time and some major aggravation and rejection to take the time to learn the craft and before you get going.
I agree with that 100%. In fact, we've had both Christopher Vogler and Donald Moss at WriterCon on previous years. Stephen James, we'll get to. He's been on the podcast, but you know, he's written a book called Story Trumps Structure, whereas my first book on writing was called Story Structure, The Key to Successful Fiction. So I feel like we're coming at this from two different directions. Except not really. I've read his book and I think it's terrific. Well, what do you mean when you talk about craft? Are we talking about structure? Are we talking about character, plotting? What are the basics?
Yeah, you know, the first thing I think that a new writer needs to understand is structure. And here's why. I'm a perfect example of this. When I started writing my David Sloan series, I was very much writing from up here. I was mm-hmm. trying to plot. I was trying to think. I was, you know, trying to put things together. And I had a couple of interesting things happen to me. I read The Nightingale and I emailed Kristen Hanna and I said, you know, where did you find this story? And she said, sometimes great stories fall in our lap and we need to get out of their way. Mm. Didn't completely understand what she was saying, but then I had read Stephen King's book on writing. And they talked about how does a writer in Seattle, Washington, touch the hearts of a reader in, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma? Mm-hmm. And his answer was telepathy, which, you know, at first you kind of go, huh? And then you begin to realize what he's talking about is he's talking about, you know, writing a book that transcends time, that transcends place and touches people's hearts. Little while later, I was in Surrey, British Columbia, and I was on a panel with Diana Gabaldon, and a gentleman in the audience stood up and said, Diana, can you talk about the magic? And Diana never missed a beat and said, sure. And she talked about how she gets home at night after going out to dinner with her husband, and she goes into her office and she lights a candle and she waits until her characters feel comfortable to come into her office and speak to her. Mm-hmm. You know, and so what you have to learn is you have to learn the basics to understand truly what a story is about so that when you get to that point where you're going to write, you're not trying too hard to fit a square into a round hole. You know the story structure so that you can focus on writing honestly and rawly. And truthfully and focus more on your character. Who is your character? What does your character want? Why does your character want it so desperately? What is the consequence if they don't get what they want? Because that's really what books are about. Those are the books that we remember as readers. Those terrific books that are about people, about characters. You know, The Great Gatsby and Edmond Dantes and Santiago and The Old Man and the Sea. I mean, that's really what we gravitate to. We gravitate to characters.
Right, right. Absolutely. So what's your writing process look like? I mean, what's your writing day look like?
Well, I am a working writer. Right. And I say that to everyone. I mean, I am usually at my desk fairly early in the morning. I try to get exercise in early. I take a Pilates class online with my sister. I started it when COVID hit and you couldn't leave the house. And it's been just a wonderful thing for me in terms of, you know, strengthening my core and just, I think exercise just frees up our mind. It helps us to focus and to concentrate. And then I'm at my desk. And when I'm writing a novel, I mean, I'm at my desk from, you know, 7-8 o'clock in the morning till 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening. Right. And I'll give you a good example. I was talking to a writer the other day and he said, you know, how are you putting out so many books? And I went and I looked at my publishing schedule and in the 2 years of the COVID crisis, I will put out 5 novels and 1 short story. And it's because, you know, what could we do, right, Bill? I mean, we get up in the morning, you can't go anywhere, you can't drive anywhere, you can't go out to dinner, you can't go out to lunch. I took solace in writing, you know, reading and writing, and I just wrote. So my process is, I'm not one of those guys that says, you know, well, I wrote for half an hour today and I met my quota of, you know, half a page and I'm good to go. You know, I just write until the muse goes away. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. You get to a point where you couldn't write a grocery list if somebody was dictating it to you. Right. And that's the time to go, okay, you know what? I'm going to go hit some golf balls. I'm going to go out in my garden and pick tomatoes, whatever, you know, and just do something different.
Right. Absolutely. Something else. So you mentioned structure. You're talking about putting in many hours a day. Pantser or planner?
I'm a pantser. I'm an organic writer.
No outlines.
I have tried to outline. Mm-hmm. And what I found, and this is another reason why I'm fast. I come from a journalism background, and journalists, you know, we write on deadline. But I found that I would spend, you know, a month putting together an outline. And on my third day of writing, I'd be off the outline. You know, something would come to me, a character would do something I wasn't expecting, and bam, I'm off the outline. I feel like if I do my research, and I mean, I'm talking about really, really digging in and really doing my correct research, and I take a lot of notes. I keep a lot of, I keep notes of every book I read, of every article I read, and I keep all those on my computer. I get to a point where it's time to tell the story. Because I've done enough research, and you know, The World Played Chess is a perfect example of that. I mean, I probably read 15 to 17 firsthand accounts of a young men's year in Vietnam. I watched just about every movie you could possibly watch. I watched Ken Burns' documentary. I watched other documentaries. And you reach a point where the research begins to become redundant. You start reading the same stories over and over again, because the experiences that these guys had was, you know, all very similar. And that's when I know, okay, I've done enough research. It's time to write.
You're ready to go. I get that totally. Yeah. I wrote a book that was set in the Dust Bowl once. And after, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 drafts, I found out there was a Ken Burns documentary on that and just said, no, I got my book. Yeah. It's not research time. It's time to finish this up. Don't be tempted. Hey, let's talk a little bit about The World Played Chess, because that's, I'm not going to say a complete departure for you, because it's not, but it's certainly not the sort of thing that people may immediately associate with you. Where did that book come from?
You know, I grew up with a mother that was a English teacher before she started having 10 kids. Yeah. And she used to hand me books when I was a young kid. I was a middle child, so you know, I suffer from the middle child syndrome. You know, my wife says I never met a microphone I didn't like, and you know, I got in some trouble in school, and I was a smart ass, and you know, all those things. And my mom started handing me books because the teachers would tell her that I was bored in school. Well, the books she was handing me were the ones I was just talking about. You know, The Count of Monte Cristo, The Old Man and the Sea, The Great Gatsby. Mm-hmm. You know. Of Mice and Men, The Lord of the Flies, you know, so many that by the time I got to high school, every time the teacher handed me a book, I'd say, I already read it. That's what I grew up reading. That's what I grew up loving. I love those stories. So, you know, when I got into this business, again, as you know, we often pick the path of least resistance, because publishing is hard. It's very hard to get published, especially today. It's even more difficult. But it's hard to get published. So, you know, I was a lawyer, and legal thrillers were very big back then. You know, Scott Turow hit it big with Presumed Innocent, and then John Grisham with The Firm. John Lesquois came out with a book that just hit it big. And so that was the path of least resistance. And so I started with the David Sloan series. But in the back of my mind, I always had this belief, this thought that I would write more literary type fiction, if that's what you want to call it, contemporary fiction. People call it a number of different things. And so I ended up writing a book, and the short of a very long story is about 10 years after I wrote it, it got published, and that was The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell. And the book did really well. It's a different, much different than readers knew my books. And so it had a slower burn to it. It took a while for people to come around to it. And now 3 years later, it's still, I think, in the top 50 of Amazon's bestseller list.
Fantastic.
It just keeps burning. So my editor, Danielle Marshall at Lake Union, said, I expect another book out of you, and I expect to get it in 3 years, because that's sort of the time that it takes. I started thinking, okay, what am I going to write about? And I started taking notes. Maybe I could write about this. Maybe I could write about that. Maybe I could write about this. And then, you know, suddenly it just sort of hit me one day. What was a really pivotal moment in my life? And one of the most pivotal moments in my life is when I was an 18-year-old and I graduated from high school. I grew up in I grew up in basic suburbia, bucolic suburbia. No crime, kids doing paper routes on their bicycles with, you know, baseball gloves and baseball bats across the bars to go play. I had a lot of brothers and sisters. I was surrounded by a lot of love. There was no, you know, real problems in my house or things like that. And I get a job on this construction crew through my brother-in-law, and I'm working with guys that aren't that much older than I am. I'm 18. These guys were about late 20s, you know, early 30s. And they had been to Vietnam. And I started, over the course of that summer, I started noticing some things about them, similarities about them. I started noticing that the one guy really started to sort of degenerate. You know, they wouldn't talk a lot about Vietnam. Not a lot of veterans, Vietnam vets, want to talk about their time in Vietnam. Right. But what would happen is we'd get done working and we'd sit in the garage and we'd have a couple beers, and the stories would slowly start to come out. And I just remember thinking to myself, you know, wow, I mean, there before the grace of God am I, right? Mm. And I didn't intend to write a book that was going to be published, you know, shortly, you know, a week after, 2 weeks after we pulled out of Afghanistan, which so many people have related to what happened in Vietnam, and which has made, I think, the book particularly timely. But really what the book is about, it's not a book about war. It's a book about coming of age. It's a book about discovering oneself and discovering that those pivotal moments in our lives that really change us.
Right. Absolutely. While I'm thinking about it, I can see there are people watching this live stream and chattering in the chat box. If you have any questions you would like to pose to Robert Degoni, just type them in there and we'll see what he has to say. So where did the title come from? I get coming of age story. It's a summer. He's talking to a Vietnam vet. Why the world played chess?
So I was in Palm Springs. I had gone down to Palm Springs for a couple of days, visit good friends, and we're going to play some golf. And he said, what are you working on? And I told him, I said, blah, blah, blah. I explained the story to him. And he looked at me, he said, sort of like that saying, the world played chess while I played checkers. And I looked at him, I said, what? He said, you've never heard that? And I said, no, I've never heard that. And he said, well, it, you know, it means you're not even playing the same game that the rest of these guys are playing. You know, you're playing a very rudimentary game. And it's a, you know, there's really a much more complex game out there. And I mean, it was like, wow, it just hit me. And it was like, that's exactly what the book's about. Mm-hmm. So when I titled it and I turned it in, you know, Lake Union initially said, we're going to look for a new title. And I kind of kept my mouth shut. And then they came back and they said, you know what, we're going to keep this title. We're going to use it. And I was really, really pleased that they did, because I really do think that's what the book is about. I mean, sometimes in order for us to grow up and to move forward, it's just a matter of us figuring out the rules of the game and learning how to play the game.
So did they learn to love the title, or could they just not think of anything better?
No,
they, really, they thought was better.
Yeah, no, they really came to love it, especially when they put the cover, when they put the title in script to make it look like a journal, that it was handwritten like a journal. Right. And then it really came full circle. They're incredibly talented people. And they have just incredibly talented people on their staff in terms of cover design and and titles and all those things. And so I'm always really pleased to let those people do their jobs, because they're so good at it.
Right. Always a pleasure to work with great people. You mentioned journaling, which is important to this book. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So this, how the story develops, and, you know, I had written a draft of the book, and in the draft, I did not have a journal in there. And it was my son who read one of my drafts. He was 23 at the time. And he said, you know what would be really interesting, Dad? It'd be really interesting for someone my age to understand what William really went through, what made him the way that he was on this construction site. You know, do you have a way that you could maybe tell the reader, tell me, you know, young men out there what he went through? I don't know anything about the Vietnam War. You know, he said, I don't know anything about it, Dad. And I really would like to know what happened to him. And that what prompted me to do all the research that I talked about. And I create a journal, which is kept by William, who's the Vietnam vet. And it's his year in Vietnam and what he experiences. And 40 years later, he mails it to Vincent, the young boy that he worked with on the construction crew. And he asks him to read the book in the order that I wrote it so that I will, you know, Vincent will understand, because it's got some really difficult moments in it. And it really unfolds and tells Vincent who William really is and what happened to him over there.
You know, I was reading some of the reviews of this book this morning, which are just, they're universally flattering, congratulatory, even effusive. I read a couple that compared you to John Irving. How does that feel?
I grew up reading John Irving, and I love John Irving, and it's humbling. It's incredibly humbling. I don't in any way, shape, or form feel that I'm at John Irving's level, Prayer for Owen Meany being one. But, if I can even be in the same universe, it's humbling. And you know, it has the book has touched a lot of people. The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell touched a lot of people. And that's, I think, because it's got just a universal, it's got a universal message in it that we can all relate to as human beings, you know, whether you're male or female, whether you're young or you're old. So many people from The Extraordinary Life of Sam Hell wrote me to tell me that they had been bullied as young kids. And, you know, what an important book it was to have a book out there about, you know, someone being bullied, but getting through it. And the message in that book is we all have the ability to lead an extraordinary life. And it's a matter, we have to believe that. And the same thing in the world played chess is we all have those moments in our life where we say, it's time to grow up. It's time for me to create my own destiny, to create my own path, to climb whatever mountain I need to climb, and to find you know, why I'm on this planet, why I'm in this world. And that's, again, that's a universal trait. That's a universal quest that we all have, I think.
You know, a couple of episodes ago, I had Lisa Scottolini on the program, and she talked about how when she was starting writing in the 90s, of course, post-Grisham, and every lawyer who wrote books was then categorized as a legal thriller writer because that was the thing to be. But she talked about how she was never really comfortable with that because she didn't think it described what she was writing very well. Did you feel kind of the same way? Because I think you did not fit the mold very well, even though you were writing books that were clearly classified as legal thrillers, a series.
Yeah, yeah. Lisa gave me one of my first blurbs ever. And
all right. She gave me a great one too, come to think of it.
Yeah, and I was in LA, one of my first book signings, and Lisa was on before me, and she could not have been more gracious and more kind. Just a really neat, wonderful lady. And I'm really so happy that she's found so much success. I mean, she had a lot of success to begin with.
But her new book, as you probably know, is nothing legal at all. It's a historical piece of wonderful fiction.
I think she's had several outside of that arena now, and has done incredibly well. I was different because I was not writing trial books. My protagonist, David Sloan, he was a lawyer, and there was legal aspects to the story. You know, someone came to him with a problem, but they were not, by and large, they were not trial books. Some had trial scenes in them, but they weren't your classic presumed innocent and the firm and things like that. So I think that was my way of rebelling a little bit, Bill, about not being dragged into the traditional legal thriller,
right?
And trying to write something that was more of a thriller or more of a mystery.
Mm-hmm. Bob, we've got a question coming in from Bill McLeod, who I know he is a Vietnam vet and has written a wonderful book of poetry about it. Anyway, he's asking, were you able to talk about any family members? Were you able to talk to any family members about their personal Vietnam experience, or was it, you know, more based on research?
Well, a couple of things. One is I remembered the stories that the two men told me. And in fact, when I was that age, I did keep a journal. And so I did have some notes of the stories that they had mm-hmm. told me, but I remembered it, their stories distinctly. I found two people that I had some prior contact with who were Vietnam veterans who were willing to talk to me. They put me in touch with some other Vietnam veterans who were not willing to talk to me, did not want to go back there, did not want to talk about their experience. The one gentleman who is a good friend of mine was a gunny sergeant in Vietnam, and I've known Bob Mannion for a number of years, and he not only helped me with the research, but he gave me manuals on the Vietnam experience, the Marine Vietnam experience, and where the Marines were located, what fire bases they were at, what type of weapons they used, what was in their go-to sacks. I mean, he gave me all the nitty-gritty, the details, the minutiae that, you know, could help me create a real experience. And then he read the manuscript. And he mm-hmm. told me things, you know, little things like, you know, they wouldn't call each other this, they wouldn't call each other that. And it helped me to go back and then, you know, restructure it, make it as real an experience as I could. And so I relied on them. I relied on Bob in particular heavily, but I relied on them heavily. But what I really needed is I needed more. And, you know, for whatever reason, I picked up Mark Baker's book, it's called NAM, N-A-M. I picked it up first edition, and it came out, I believe, sometime in the late 70s or early 80s. And I picked it up because of the experience that I had. And I just read it. And what it is it's just excerpts of stories that Vietnam veterans told about mm-hmm. their experience in Vietnam. And there's hundreds and hundreds of them in that book. And then from there, I found other books that did the same thing. And so what I did is I took all those stories. I took the information that my sources gave me. And then I took the stories that I recalled of the two veterans that I worked with. And I just sort of molded them all together and changed them and created them and tried to create William's experience over there.
Right. Sounds like what writers do. You know, I think you might actually enjoy Bill McLeod's book. I should have said the title of that book of poetry is The Smell of the Light. Just Ooh. Fantastic stuff. Now, in the publicity materials that I received, it mentions that you spent a pivotal summer working before you went to Stanford, and that may have had some influence on this book. What happened?
Well, I went to work with these two Vietnam vets, and you know, it's I want to emphasize that it's fiction in terms of Vincent the character, but it's also, you know, based upon my own experiences. I did go to work with them. I did, you know, work on the construction of a house, and many of the things in there on those days are true. Mm-hmm. It really did happen. But the pivotal point was just the shattering of illusions, I think, you know, Bill, is really the big thing is I suddenly realized that the world was a lot bigger than I thought it was. And the world was a lot more complicated and a lot more complex. And, you know, in a lot of ways, in a lot of aspects, you know, as young men, we're expected to, one day we're in high school and we're young men, and then we graduate and we're supposed to be adults, you know, we're mm-hmm. supposed to be men. Well, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean? And there's no manual out there. You're not going to find an owner's manual on what it means to be a man, what it means to be a husband, what it means to be a father. You know, and it's just, you're just thrown into it. And some of us go off to college and some of us go off to war and some of us go off to work. And, you know, I went off to college, but I went off to college with a lot less naivete than I had when I started that summer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I'm going to ask the hard question, so brace yourself, because here it comes. Most of the characters in this book are male.
Yes.
And as you heard me say during the news segment, there are an increasing number of female readers, which is, there's nothing new about that. But in a world where publishers are starting to classify thrillers as something else because they don't want to alienate female readers, what's the takeaway or what's the draw for women to read this book, The World Played Chess?
So I can give you an example, I think, which will kind of summarize better than I can say, but, and then I'll answer the question. But I've had several interviews like the one we're having right now. Mm-hmm. And I've had two with women who couldn't get through their questions because they were in tears. Mm-hmm. And they were in tears because the experience was so personal for them. One woman actually said to me, she's from Florida, she said, I will never look out my kitchen window again and not think of William, the veteran.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And, another woman said to me, my father served in Vietnam. And I often wondered what really happened to him, because there would be moments in our lives where you could just tell there was something not right. And, they were incredibly emotional about it. So this is really not a man's story. It just happens that the characters and the lessons that the character Vincent is learning, he's a man. But it's a universal lesson, whether you're male or female, whether you're young or old, whatever your race. And that universal lesson is that the world can be a big, impersonal, and difficult place. And, we have to, at some point, cut the tethers that we have to our parents, to our teachers, to our mentors. And we have to go out in the world and we have to survive. We have to find our place. And this is a story about, one young man in particular, who he says he'd been to hell. He'd been to hell and back. And that was a true story that the veteran who I call William, that's what he said to me. I asked him one time if he was born Catholic, why he no longer believed in God. And he said, because I've been to hell and he wasn't there. Yeah. So, I think it's universal, Bill. It's a story that everyone can kind of look back on their own life and say, wow, when was that moment for me? It could be when, the birth of a child. I mean, that was a moment for me when my wife gave birth and we had a problem with the insurance company. I mean, I'll tell you right now, I would have crawled up the side of the insurance company building on my, knees and with my knuckles bleeding to get a hold of the insurance agent and say, my wife is not leaving the hospital today. I don't care what your policy says.
Right.
But you have to go through those experiences. And that's what this book is about.
Mm. Fantastic. So I know a lot of people are listening to this and just hearing you talk about it, it's probably making everybody want to read this book. And some of the writers out there are thinking, what's the secret ingredient? How do I bring my writing up to the Degoni level? I want to do what he's doing. What are some of the lessons that you've learned or the tricks of the trade? Or, you've done 20 plus books, I think.
Yes.
What have you learned since you did those first few books?
The biggest thing, is what I talked about earlier. All those writers who are much more successful than I am. When did they find success, and how did they find success? And what I have come to believe and learn is you have to write from your heart. You have to write characters that are raw and honest and open and have flaws and feel things and you have to write from your heart. You can't, mm-hmm. I just don't think you can expect to touch a reader's heart if you're not putting your own heart out there. And that's a really difficult thing to do because, as you know, there are a lot of people out there that are waiting to step on that heart. They're going to look at your art, the thing that you do for a living, and they're going to say how much they hate it and why they hate it. They're going to go look at a painting in the Louvre and they're going to say, this is crap. You know, they're going to see a sculpture and they're going to say, this is lousy and what's wrong with it? And you have to just get past that. You have to say to yourself, love it or hate it.
Right.
At least it impacted you. You know, to hate something, you have to have some really strong feelings about it. And that means that, you know, your book or your painting or whatever it was, it impacted that reader. So, you know, I think the most important thing is write from your heart. Don't be afraid. You know, just don't be afraid.
So it means something to you. It's going to mean something to somebody else. At this point, I feel like I've had some books that were bestsellers. I've had some that completely tanked. But if you wrote it for the right reason, you know, you had a reason for writing it and you delivered, it doesn't matter so much. I mean, I'd rather have the hit than the bomb, but still, I wrote the book I wanted to write.
Yeah, you know, I heard Greg Olson speak one time about the book out there that I think it's called Tell No One, if I'm getting that correctly. I hope I'm getting it correctly. And it's a true story. And it was a really hard book for him to write. It was a very difficult book for him to write. And he really didn't know how it was going to be accepted. And I mean, I think it's been on the bestseller list for, you know, over 2 years. It's been a mega hit. And, you know, really it's a book that he wrote from his heart, but he had to please himself first. And I think that's the most important thing, is write the book you want to write. And yeah, you're not going to always hit a home run, but nobody always hits a home run.
Right. That may be, unless you write the same book over and over again, and who wants to do that? I don't.
I don't know what you do, but this is another thing I think for writers is I always challenge myself in every book. And for instance, the last Tracy book I just wrote that'll be out, I think next February. My challenge was I wanted it, although it was written in third person, I wanted every scene to be from her perspective, every single scene. Mm-hmm. And I did it. And I think, you know, it's a strong book for that reason. I've had other books where I decided, you know what, I really want to have a real battle with an antagonist in this book. And, you know, I did it. And I think that's important to keep things fresh, to keep things different, to keep you interested, to keep you challenged, which is really important when you're a writer.
I think so too. And that's sort of going to be my segue into talking about another way you give back, which is all the teaching you do, the writing seminars. You're doing one now for the Pacific Northwest Conference, and I know you've done others in the past. How'd you get started with that?
I was looking for a way to get my name out there, you know, and I, just like everybody else, you know, when I started, we didn't have all the social media we have today. Right. And, you know, it's how do you get your name noticed? And it's, you know, it was going to conferences and, okay, I'm at a conference. Well, how do I get noticed at a conference? Well, you get on a panel. Well, then you're on a panel with all these really famous writers and you're like the slice of bologna, you know, and nobody's paying attention to you. So then, you know, I found out, wow, they have people that teach. And then my first thought was, oh man, what am I going to teach? And then I thought, no, you know what? I spent 3 years giving myself an MFA because I wanted to learn the craft of writing. And I have binders and you can see them up on my shelves. Those binders are all binders on story structure and character development and pacing and tension. And, you know, all these things that, you know, I studied, and because I'm a lawyer and I'm anal, I took all these notes. And so I said, you know, they asked me if I could teach a class on character development, and I was back in Falmouth, Massachusetts, and I had an 80-page outline that I handed out to my students. And, you know, I was in this class, Bill, and there was like 15 people in my class, and, you know, next door were some really big name writers, and they were teaching things like how to write a New York Times bestseller, and their class had 80 people in them. And every time we would take a break, there would be another 15 people outside of my door asking if they could get into my class and did I have any more of the handout. And so, you know, the gentleman who ran the conference came to me and said, what the hell are you doing? You know, you're upstaging these other authors, and, you know, what do you, and so he said, I'm going to give you your own conference. And that was really the start of it. I started teaching lawyers who wanted to write books, and I started teaching doctors who wanted to write books, and I'd fly to Chicago and we'd have a really intense 2.5 days. And from there, it just sort of snowballed. And, you know, I do think that we all have been in the same place. I'm sure of it. I think I might have come across one or two authors in my day that didn't struggle. at some point they didn't struggle and they didn't go through that thing where they get, you know, the publisher no longer wants to publish their books, or, you know, they can't get an agent or whatever it is. We all. And so, you know, I just feel like it's important to give back and to try to help authors get published. There are so many out there that are so talented. Stephen James and I, we do an intensive seminar called the Novel Writing Intensive. And, you know, your listeners and viewers can find it online, the Novel Writing Intensive. And it's an intense, you know, 3.5-day course. And, you know, I have read some incredibly talented 50 pages that authors will submit. And, you know, they're so good that I'll say, can I read the rest of the book? And I'll read the rest of the book and I'll think, man, this is as good, if not better than 75% of the stuff I'm reading out there. Mm. But they can't find an agent and they can't find that, or they just can't get that break. They can't get that foot in the door.
Sure.
And I you know, we all know how hard that is. And so, you know, if I can help them, you know, I will. At the same time, we all have limited amount of time and we're trying to, you know, to get our own stuff published and all that too. But you know, it's an opportunity to give back and to maybe try to help some of these people.
Not going to put you on the spot, but as I hear you talking about that, of course, I'm thinking we need to get you and Steve out to WriterCon, because I think that Novel Writing Intensive would be a huge hit.
Yeah, I would love it. I would love it. It's you know, people ask me why I do it, and it's like going to camp where everybody has the exact same interests.
Right.
Everybody loves books. Everybody loves writing, and so. You know, I've met some of the best people I know have remained my friends from those conferences.
So true.
It's really good people.
Okay, one last question. Given the multitude of possibilities, what should readers be expecting from you next?
Well, I'll have another Tracy Crosswhite book coming out. I think it's the 9th. It's called What She Found, and that will be out, I think, next February. The third and probably the final, I don't know for sure, book in the Charles Jenkins espionage series called The Silent Sisters will be out I believe November. And then in between that, I have a short story, which is the story of Tracy Crosswhite's two partners, Dell and Faz, when they were rookies. And that's going to be an Amazon short, which will be coming out, I believe, in October. If I'm correct. So a lot of good things coming, and I'm writing another standalone, but it's going to be a standalone thriller. It's going to have some legal elements involved in it. And I'm real excited about that.
Sounds terrific. Well, we got to get you back here when one of those comes out, whichever one turns out next. Hey, thanks so much for being on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you. My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was an honor.
Absolutely. Well, there you have it. Let me just say a few quick words. If you are writing or thinking about writing, I think I mentioned this earlier, there is a Red Sneaker Writers Facebook group, probably soon a Twitter community, but for right now, a Facebook group. And yeah, you have to ask to join, but I let everybody in, so don't worry about it. Just sign up and you'll get the daily updates and what's going on in the publishing world and what new programs are being offered by the Red Writer Sneakers Center. Let me also remind you that this podcast is ad-free, supported by our patrons. I've got a site on Patreon, patreon.com/Wilburn, WILLBERN. If you want to support this podcast, if you're looking for some mentoring for your writing, that's the place to go. Until next time, hey, all of you, keep writing. And remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit. See you next time.